Well, it's been a couple of years since I've published any episodes. But hey, I mean, it's back. I mean, sounds like it. I don't have shit else to do for the next little bit. So I had an actual professional job that part of it was recording a podcast. I'm not going to mention it because I don't want to drive any traffic there per se. I'm very happy with the work that I've done. But I talked with some fairly important people about some fairly important topics, none of which are really relevant to what goes on here, or I guess nothing's really been going on here for a long time. But for those of you who are new to Adventures in Wikipedia, welcome, welcome, you curious minds, you. You're listening to Adventures in Wikipedia. It's a podcast. We go on an exhilarating journey down the vast and winding roads of the world's biggest encyclopedia. So if you've ever found yourself starting with one simple Wikipedia search, only to find that, you know, hours later, you're 20 pages deep into a rabbit hole of unrelated but intriguing topics. We've all been there. I mean, that's what this podcast is. We're diving into the depths of Wikipedia. We're going to connect some dots. We're going to surf some waves of information and take us from, you know, prehistoric eras to futuristic technologies, tropical islands, galaxies, everything in between. So hopefully, you know, if everything works out, each week we're going to embark on a new adventure. We're fueled by curiosity here, people, and a love of learning, also fueled by boredom. We'll unravel some stories, uncover facts, and explore ideas that you might never have come across before. So it's about making those connections that spark creativity, challenge our perceptions, and give us a whole new understanding of the world that we inhabit. So buckle up, everyone, as we plunge into the rabbit hole and take on the journey of a lifetime. This is Adventures in Wikipedia. So this is where I would play, you know, the music theme, which I'm probably going to do right now. All right, so there you have it. There's the fancy little musical transition. And hey, guys, I mean, we're back. We're back. For those of you who've never listened to it, hopefully, I mean, it's been like since June of 2019, since I've recorded anything on this particular channel, actually been one of the more successful channels that I've ever recorded, even though I got paid to do it professionally for a little bit, if you want to even call it that. But I digress. So on this channel, we're going to sit back and look at what they have chilling on Wikipedia. This beautiful morning. Today is June 13th. I do believe it's a Tuesday. And here in Central Time, it's about 11:48 in the AM. What am I doing? I'm doing this for the time being. I'm a full-time podcaster now. So I'm just going to record as much content as I can and see if we can't build this channel back out. So what we're going to look at today on the homepage is on this day in history. So it looks like back in 1916, in World War I, there was a little battle called the Battle of Mont Sorel. And I apologize for any mispronunciations. I'm not out here to offend anybody. I'm simply a wish.com type educator. But this battle was between the British Empire, Canada, and the United Kingdom against the German Empire and the Kingdom of Bavaria. So it looks like the Battle of Mont Sorel, which was Battle of Hill 62, was a local operation in World War I by three divisions of the British Second Army and three divisions of the German Fourth Army in the, see, here we are, with Ypres Salient near Ypres, Belgium, from 2 to 13 June in 1916. And me trying to pronounce that, it's Y-P-R-E-S. I could Google how to pronounce that properly, but I'm not going to. Apologies. So to divert British resources from the buildup being observed in the Somme, the 13th Royal Wittenberg Corps, I do speak German, so I have a little bit better ability when it comes to die deutsche Satze oder Namen. So, and the 117th Infantry Division attacked an arc of high ground defended by the Canadian Corps. So the German forces captured the heights at Mount Sorel and Tortop, which, for those of you who don't know, Tor is German for a tower. So this is before they entrenching on the far slope of the ridge. Sorry, that's my phone ringing. I have gotten more spam risk calls in the past. This number is 972-945-1948. If you're listening to this and this is you calling me, please stop. I know I am behind on some payments for some stuff. I know what those are. I've already interacted with you, so I know that this has to just be a simple thing. I don't even know where I was at with the battle. But following a number of attacks and counterattacks, two divisions of the Canadian Corps, supported by the 20th Light Division and 2nd Army Siege and Howitzer Battery Groups, recaptured a majority of their former positions. So does it say who won? It looks like the British Empire suffered somewhere around 8,400 casualties and losses, while the German Empire lost around, you know, I'm going to round this up to 5,800. And this is a battle on the Western Front, where all was quiet. So this was a big German offensive battle, it looks like. So I'm going to go ahead and click on World War One, or let's look at the Canadian Corps. Let's check out the Canadian Corps. It was a World War One corps formed from the Canadian Expeditionary Force. It started in September of 1915 after the arrival of the 2nd Canadian Division in France. The corps was expanded by the addition of the 3rd Canadian Division in December 1915 and the 4th Canadian Division in August 1916. So the organization of a 5th Canadian Division began in February of 1917, but it was still not fully formed when it was broken up in February of 1918, and its men used, they were all used to reinforce the other four divisions. So majority of the soldiers of the Canadian Corps were British-born Canadians until near the end of the war, when a number of these Canadian-born enlisted, you know, it rose to 51%. I don't know what that means. I'm pretty sure I read that wrong. But if we look at the quick data that they have in the little snippet, it's from 1915 to 1919, the Canadian Expeditionary Force was four divisions, and it was part of various British field armies, commanded by, looks like at first, General Sir Edwin Anderson. And then that was from 1915 to 1916. 1916 to 1917 was General Sir Julian Byng, B-Y-N-G. Hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And then from 1917 to 1919, General Sir Arthur Currie. Let's go ahead and look up Mr. Arthur Currie. That's a very familiar name. He has lots of different acronyms, or I guess, are those acronyms? It says Sir General Arthur William Currie, GCMG, and KCB. What does that mean? GCMG is the Most Distinguished Order of St. Michael and St. George. It's a British order of chivalry founded in April of 1818 by George, Prince of Wales. And then this KCB is the Most Honorable Order of the Bath. It's a British order of chivalry founded by King George I back in 1725. I mean, seems pretty legit. I myself am a member of a U.S. Armor and Cavalry Association order, the Order of St. George, but it's not the same thing. Not the same thing at all. Shout out to all my armor fellows out there. I was going to look into this guy a little bit more. It looks like he was born 5 December 1875 on a farm near the hamlet of Naperton, Ontario. So just a standard Canadian guy. Let's look at this guy. I mean, it looks like he fought through World War One, and he was the Inspector General of the Armed Forces and Canadian Corps, 1st Canadian Division, and 2nd Canadian Brigade. In that reverse order, I think I worked my way from the most prestigious to where he started. So he was awarded the Knight Grand Cross of the Order of St. Michael and St. George, Knight Commander, it's actually a cool name, of the Order of the Bath, mentioned in dispatches, Chevalier of the Legion of Honneur, it's in French, and then the Croix de la Guerre. This is all French. He's got a bunch of other foreign awards that have, you know, a bunch of different, more difficult to pronounce names. Wow, this guy looks like a badass. I'm looking at him in a picture with officers of the 5th Regiment at the McLawley Point in 1909. He's seated on a bench from the left, far left. So I guess that's him right there. You can't see this. Maybe at some point I'll put video on this. The next one I'll try to make on the video. So looks like he was a brigade commander for the Second Battle of Ypres and then Battle of Mount Sorel. That's what kind of started this, because it happened, you know, a long time ago on this day. So I'm going to kind of skip ahead and see how this guy died. It looks like he died of a stroke, 5 November 1933. No, I'm sorry. He suffered a stroke, another stroke. Looks like he had more than one, but just to read it aloud. Curry suffered another stroke on 5 November 1933 and died on 30 November at the age of 57 at Royal Victoria Hospital from bronchial complications brought on by pneumonia. So his civil and military funeral on 5 December was held in Montreal and was the largest to that point in Canadian history. The Times wrote of his funeral saying it was, by common consent, the most impressive funeral ever seen at Montreal. And Robert Borden believed the ceremony was perhaps more elaborate than any state or military funeral in the history of Canada. Approximately 150,000 people lined the streets to watch the procession, and the Canadian Radio Broadcasting Commission broadcast the funeral over the radio. Those attending the funeral included Lord Bessborough and, at the time, Governor General of Canada. So let's look up this gentleman right here, Lord Bessborough. Earl of Bessborough. So this is these names. This is the 14th Governor General of Canada. Vere Brabazon Ponsonby, 9th Earl of Bessborough. He's also got a bunch of acronyms, the GCMG and KSJ and PC. He was an Anglo-Irish businessman and politician who served as Governor General of Canada, the 14th since the Canadian Federation. Born and educated in England into the ascendancy. What is that? The ascendancy. Protestant ascendancy, also known simply as the ascendancy, was the political, economic, and social domination of Ireland between 17th century and early 20th century by a minority of landowners, Protestant clergy, and members of the professions. So all members of the established church, which is the Anglican Church of Ireland or the Church of England. The ascendancy excluded other groups from politics, and either the elite, most numerous among the Roman Catholics, but also members of the Presbyterian and other Presbyterian denominations, along with non-Christians such as Jews, until the Reform Acts. That was from 1832 to 1928. And again, I'm reading this exactly as it states on Wikipedia.org/wiki/Protestant_ascendancy, if you'd like to check that out. There's a lot going on here. I'm not 100% sure that this is the rabbit hole I want to get down, but it looks like the gradual disposition of large holdings belonged to several hundred native Catholic nobility and other landowners in Ireland. This took place in various stages from the reigns of the Catholic Church. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The Catholic Mary I and her Protestant half-sister Elizabeth I. Let's check out Elizabeth I, because this is a long time ago. Elizabeth the First, Queen of England and Ireland, starting in 17 November of 1558. So there's been more than one Queen Elizabeth. She was the daughter of Henry the Eighth and Anne Boleyn, which was his second wife, who was executed when Elizabeth was 2 years old. And Anne's marriage to Henry was annulled, and Elizabeth was for a time declared illegitimate. After Henry, Elizabeth's half-brother Edward the Sixth ruled until his own death in 1553, bequeathing the crown to a cousin, Lady Jane Grey, and ignoring the claims of his two half-sisters, the Catholic Mary and the younger Elizabeth, in spite of a salute to the contrary. Who's Lady Jane Grey? Wow, this painting is old. I mean, she reigned from 10 July of 1553 to 19 July 1553. Hey, that's a longer English reign than, you know, me. But Lady Jane Grey, later known as Lady Jane Dudley after she was married again, and also known as the Nine Days Queen, which is kind of cool, was an English noblewoman who claimed the throne of England and Ireland from 10 July until 19 July of 1553. Jane was the great-granddaughter of Henry the... Sorry, these are in Roman numerals. So this is Henry the VII, which is the seventh, though his young daughter Mary, which I may have said Henry the Eighth last, but was the first cousin of once removed Edward the Sixth. She had an excellent humanist education and a reputation as one of the most learned young women of her day. And it looks like in May of 1553, so this is right before she was queen, she married Lord Guildford Dudley. Let's check out this gentleman. Oh, what a strapping young fellow. Also spelt a different way. I'm not even going to try. Lord Guildford Dudley, an English nobleman who was married to Lady Jane Grey. She occupied the English... We already, you know, read that out. But it doesn't look like... His coat of arms looks kind of cool. It's a green dragon. Or is that a griffin? Green griffin with two tails. Looks like they're growing ivy on them. Kind of neat looking. King Edward, in his devise of the succession, settled the crown on Jane Grey, his first cousin once removed, by passing his half-sister Mary and Elizabeth. After Edward's death on 6 July 1553, the Duke of Northumberland undertook the enforcement of the king's will. So the envoys of the Holy Roman Empire and France were sure of the plan's success. Jane was reluctant to accept the crown. She gave in after remonstrances, whatever that means, by an assembly of nobles. Imprisonment. Looks like this dude. It says on 10 July, the same day as Jane's proclamation, a letter from Mary Tudor arrived in London saying that she was now queen and demanding the obedience of the council. Mary was assembling her supporters in East Anglia. It was decided to take the field again. So, not to completely get off track here, but England is not that big. And just to see how much back and forth there was, even the United Kingdom. I'm going to go off of Wikipedia really quick, and we're just going to check out how many United Kingdoms fit into the United States. Huh? With a total area of almost 3.8 million square miles, the United States is approximately 40 times the size of the United Kingdom, which itself is comprised of four countries: England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. I'm just going to think about that for a second. 40 times the size of the United Kingdom. Can you imagine if instead of, you know, what do they call it? The British Isles, right? It was America. And they were just populating that bad boy for a couple hundred years. Could you imagine the scale of the wars. I mean, think about the scale of it like afterwards. I mean, it wasn't too crazy just because it took so long for the West to become settled. But there was a lot going on politically. I guess that's what happens when you get a lot of noble people, noblemen in a really small area. Because like a lot of these battles and stuff, it doesn't sound like a lot of it. I mean, conquest of Wales and Ireland and Scotland and all that. Anyways, not to get off of that, but just 40 times the size. I mean, they did get Canada. I'm surprised more noble people from Canada or from England didn't migrate to Canada. I mean, why was that? Is it not as rich? Is it not as, I mean, I know it's colder. It's a lot further north, but I mean, it's on the same parallel. I don't know. I digress. I'm going to get off of that. This simply says execution. I do believe we're still talking about Lord Guildford Dudley. On 10 July, the same day. Oh, no, that's imprisonment. Execution. Queen Mary I's plan to marry Philip II of Spain was greeted with widespread opposition, not just among the populace, but among members of Parliament and privy councilors. So Thomas Wyatt's rebellion in early 1554, in which the Duke of Suffolk took part, resulted from this dislike. I don't understand what I just read right there. Who's Thomas Wyatt's rebellion? Let's read about that. Was a limited and unsuccessful uprising in England in early 1554, led by four men. It seems like you'd need more guys than that, but led by four men, one of whom was Sir Thomas Wyatt. It was given its name by the solicitor at Wyatt's arraignment, who stated, for the record, that this shall be ever called Wyatt's Rebellion. The rebellion arose out of concern over Queen Mary's determination to marry a foreigner, Philip II, Prince of Spain, and to return England to Catholicism and papal authority. The uprising failed with consequences for the rebels that range from death to forgiveness. Death, I mean, obviously. Let's see who participated. Sir Thomas Wyatt, Sir James Croft, Sir Peter Carew, Henry Grey, the Duke of Suffolk, who we talked about briefly, William Thomas. I guess we didn't talk about Henry Grey. The lady was, her last name was Grey. Edward Courtenay, other rebels. There's just other rebels. Sir Nicholas Arnold and Leonard Digges, who was a scientist. Let's click on this gentleman. 1515 to 1594 was a well-known English mathematician and surveyor credited with the invention of the theodolite. What's a theodolite? This is kind of cool. It's a precision optical instrument for measuring angles between designated visible points in the horizon and vertical planes. I mean, it looks a bit like a sextant, but this is a direct readout theodolite manufactured in the Soviet Union in 1958, used for topographic surveying. So surveying equipment. He was a surveyor. He made one of these things. I've seen these before, actually. I never heard it called that. I guess. Oh, yeah. Optical readout theodolite. Huh. Index errors. There's errors in measurement. So the angles in the vertical axis should read 90 degrees or 100 grads when the sighting axis is horizontal, or 270 degrees, 300 grad when the instrument is transiting. This is really boring reading about surveying equipment. Sorry about that, but just wanted to hear about Leonard Digges. I guess he developed a type of telescope, and there's all kinds of stuff on him. Let's go back a little bit, back to Wyatt's Rebellion. Sir Thomas Wyatt owned large areas of land in Kent and had great influence there. Although he initially seemed to have supported Mary, he did declare her to be queen. he was against her marriage to Philip, saying that it would lead to the most miserable servitude and established popish religion. However, Wyatt cautioned against using religion as the reason for the rebellion, for that will withdraw from us the hearts of Maine. The way they spell this, you must only make your quarrel for overrulings by strangers. I just want to point out how this is spelled. For that will, W-I-L, withdraw from us the hearts, H-E-A-R-T-E-S, of Maine, M-A-N-Y-E, Maine, hearts of Maine. You must only make your quarrel for O-U-E-R-U-N-N-I-N, right? I don't know. I'm done with this. Done with this. Let's look at this area that they were trying to take over. So this is a picture of Allington's castle. I'm looking at it on the map. It's in like a southeast portion of the British, English, England. I'm going to get out of here. Allington Castle. Cool, bro. Let's go back a little bit further to where we were. We were talking about Lady Jane Grey. Bunch of references on here. Take a little drink. I don't know. We're about 20-something minutes in. I'm going to call that good. Thanks for stopping by. Look forward to chatting with y'all again here soon. Okay, thanks. Bye. I can't stop the recording.